theory. I can only tell you about some symmetries of M theory. This talk is really aimed at trying to answer some questions that I asked myself about what various claims to be found in the literature about symmetries of M theory really are. These date back to at least 1984, to my knowledge, where people looked at hidden symmetries for 11-dimensional supergravity and found indications that if you compactified, so if you did not compactify things down, but just simply regarded the theory as an 11-dimensional theory, then you would discover some kind of hidden symmetry that had something to do with E7 or E8. That's originally the work of DeWitt and Nicolai, and subsequently many others. Also, there has been recent work where the roles of E10 and E11 are speculated about, and whilst I don't have very much to say about that, the fact that people have made such speculations means that one should go back and examine precisely what it is that you can say about these symmetry groups, if anything. The starting point, what I'm going to say, is will be entirely within the context of the canonical theory, and I wanted to have, first of all, look a little bit at just canonical general relativity to see that there is a clue there as to how you might proceed to understand some of these more deeper problems. So in canonical general relativity, what you do is you perform a space-time split of the metric and try and isolate some of the physical degrees of freedom. And so what you do is you write the metric in a way which emphasizes this split into space and time as separate objects. Typically, you write alpha squared dt squared plus gamma ij into dxi plus beta I dt dxj plus beta j dt, so that you've written everything in terms of the lapse alpha, a shift vector beta I, and a spatial metric, gamma ij, that is positive definite. I'm going to be looking at what happens in d plus 1 space-time dimensions. And if you do that, then gamma ij will be a positive definite metric that is d-dimensional. Well, I guess we all know what happens next. If you try to isolate the canonical degrees of freedom in this theory, you will discover that the lapse and the shift are variables which you can basically gauge away, and that the spatial metric is the thing that you want to concentrate on. Formally, what you will discover is that if you substitute this ansatz into the Einstein action, there is no momentum conjugate to alpha, there is no momentum conjugate to beta, so those are objects which you can gauge away if you wish, and I will choose to work in the synchronous gauge, alpha equals 1, beta I equals 0, in everything that follows. That makes life easy. You don't have to do this, it just makes it much easier to see what's going on. So this is a gauge choice.
One began to rediscuss, can you always do that? And what are the global constraints of space-time? Could you elaborate a little bit on what are global constraints in space-time which would disallow you?
Not allow you to do this.
Yes.
I really didn't want to do that for the very simple reason that everything that I had to do will be local.
Obviously, these gauge choices are difficult. I mean, for example, you can locally do this, but if you want to do it globally, say, for example, suppose you try to do this for Schwarzschild metric, you will find it rather hard. I think.
No, that was absolutely not what I was on my mind at all. So what you can then do is to go ahead and ask what is left of the theory, and there are a number of ways of doing this. A way that is popular is to say, well, there are going to be some secondary constraints, which come from saying that the momentum conjugate to these things must be preserved in time. Those give rise to diffeomorphism constraints.
Malcolm, can I ask you a quick question? Even if you were worried about things happening globally, or I'm not sure exactly where you're going, but if you're interested in kind of uncovering symmetries, for what you're going to do, would it be sufficient to be able to do this asymptotically? I mean, do you have to worry? If someone brought up the objection of, well, you can't do this globally, would that really matter?
Since what I'm going to end up doing is going to be something at every point in space, I think you don't have to worry about that particular problem, at least as far as I'm concerned here. And there is a point about whether or not you can do this globally is important. If we really want to try to answer this question, let me give you an example. It has nothing to do with asymptotia in any way, shape, or form. The question is, first of all, when can you write a metric like this thing globally? So to be able to do that, what you need is a globally well-defined timelike vector. This has nothing to do with what I'm going to be saying. And we can all think of examples of spacetimes in which there is no such thing. The obvious one is indeed Schwarzschild. Well, actually, maybe that's not an obvious one. That doesn't work.
And it's just time with CTCs.
Well, that doesn't do, yeah. Flat space, though. So here's the example of one that doesn't work. Here is flat space between two timeline slices and identify top and bottom. That will do. Or I suppose we could do the same thing with ABS if we wanted to. If we decided that version of ABS is identifiable, would suffice. So you certainly need a globally well-defined time coordinate. Then there's an issue of whether or not you can make this choice everywhere. And that's rather more complicated. But I don't think this is relevant, so I'm going to forget about it. So we end up with a diffeomorphism constraint. Try this list for completeness. Chi I is minus 2 times di of dj of chi ij. Chi ij will be the momentum conjugate gamma. And there will be the Hamiltonian constraint, which is equal to, and this one is important, gamma minus half pi ij minus 1 over d minus 1 pi squared, this being the trace of pi with respect to metric gamma, plus the determinant of gamma times the Ricci scalar of d-dimensional metric in angle gamma. So that's the Hamiltonian constraint. So the first point to get hold of here is to look at the Hamiltonian constraint and realize that this looks a bit like, not completely like, but a bit like the mass shell constraint for a particle. You can go a little bit further than that. You can ask yourself, what are the equations of motion for gamma? These are basically the Einstein equations for the spatial metric, which is all that is left in the problem. Those you can compute from, if you like, the Hamiltonian, and you will discover the following equations. The second derivative of the metric plus something
which I'll write as gamma ij kl mn, gamma dot kl, gamma dot mn, is equal to minus 2 times Ricci tensor minus 1 over 2 to d minus 1 metric times the Ricci scalar. And these are the Ricci scalar and Ricci tensor made out of the d-dimensional metric gamma. Dot here refers to d by dt. This is the equation will hold at each point in space. So let's stare at this equation for a little bit. Suppose that the right-hand side wasn't there. Then we would all stare at this thing and say, oh, this is the geodesic equation at each point in space, meaning that you regard the metric as a function of x, and it would simply evolve following the geodesic equation controlled by some set of Christoffel symbols, gamma. So in the absence of the right-hand side, by writing it at x, I mean at each individual point in space. It holds pointwise. This thing isn't here. This will, of course, connect different points in space because this involves derivatives. This, however, holds at each point in space and is therefore dramatically different. What you then need to ask yourself is, what is it the geodesic equation on? This gamma, this set of Christoffel symbols, represents Christoffel symbols, the connection of some particular metric, and the thing to do is to identify what space this is in. So, what space is this geodesic equation on? Call this M at each point in space. The easiest way to solve this problem is to go back to the Hamiltonian constraint and rewrite this in a slightly different way. We can say that really what this is, well, no, maybe we don't want to do it that way. We're probably better off skipping lots of algebraic details, so let's just simply cut to the answer. The metric on M, you have to ask yourself, what are the coordinates? Well, the coordinates are just simply the generalized coordinates of the problem. They're gamma ij at each point. Elements of the metric. There will be a half d into d plus one of these things. So if you're interested in the metric, then the way in which you find the metric is to say, well, you want to compute a length given a gamma. That you would do by saying that you have something like this, where this thing is the metric. And the metric is essentially the thing which governs this part of the Hamiltonian constraint over here. And if you want an explicit formulation for this thing, GIJKL is equal to half determinant gamma to the 1/2, gamma IK, gamma JL, plus gamma IL, gamma JK, minus twice gamma IJ, gamma KL. So that is an explicit representation of what the metric is, at each point in space. Sometimes called the DeWitt metric.
Should we think of variations of the metric in this contraction of the metric with the two gammas, or this delta gamma?
Yeah, you should. Well, you can think of those as being little things on the metric like that. That will give you a something like dx squared. So this will be the distance between two different metrics at the same point. Sometimes called the superspace metric. It's a metric on the space of all metrics, if you like. So there are various things that you can do with this thing. One thing is to compute its signature. The signature of this thing has one minus sign, and the rest of them are pluses. So it's plus to the half d, d plus 1, minus 1. So it has one time-like direction. And this time-like direction corresponds to a overall scaling. That is to say, if you thought that you wanted to look at a delta gamma ij, look something like lambda times gamma ij, that's a direction which will give you something which is a time-like displacement. Fairly obviously, if you go over here to the Hamiltonian, it corresponds to the direction in which you have to go move in order to get something with the wrong sign of what looks like a kinetic energy term. This minus sign is the same sign that is famous for giving you the wrong sign conformal factor in Euclidean gravity. What about the bit that's orthogonal to this? This space here is just a symmetric. What's left is symmetric on symmetric space. You have to ask yourself which symmetric space. And the answer is SLD quotiented by SOD. That should immediately tell you something which is intriguing. Namely, if you think about the duality groups for just pure gravity, they are exactly the same things. And they're exactly the same things for the because this thing corresponds to the symmetry of the problem, even as long as you have three vectors in that particular direction, under which circumstances that driving term over there won't exist. So, in the absence of the driving term, the Ricci tensor type thing, then the motion of the metric will just be geodesics at each point in space. You, of course, have to glue them together. The diffeomorphism constraint tells you how to glue them together. But what you have learned is that this metric space controls the dynamics of the theory, and you should regard this R as being a bit like a potential, which tells you how the deviation from free particle motion happens at each point in space. And of course, you recognize this SOD as being the remains of the Lorentz group once you've done the space-time split and frozen out the time coordinate. One last thing, which I suppose is important stuff, but not really from the development of this, but is important about the width metric. Whilst the metric on this symmetric space is perfectly well defined, and there's nothing singular about it, on this whole space, there are singularities corresponding to when this sort of overall conformal scale of the metric vanishes. So the space of all metrics is itself singular. Which leads it to interesting problems that I don't think we have to get trying to get into right now. So that's what happens if you just do pure general relativity. And if that's all I had to say, it wouldn't be very interesting. So what I want to do now is to move to 11-dimensional supergravity. I'll just stick in the bosonic fields for the moment because that's all I can do easily. Yes.
If you change the relative size of the two terms, like the minus two, does that change the properties of the signature?
This thing?
Yeah.
The answer is yes. This minus two is the number that you get from the Einstein form of the action. You could, for example, change this to plus 100 or something like that, in which case you'd be guaranteed that it would be a positive definite metric, but it would not correspond to what you got from general relativity. It would be a metric on the space of all metrics, but it would not be the one that is inherited from the theory. So let's move on to M theory and do that concretely. So I'll just do the free form for the moment because I didn't even have much of an opportunity to do much else. So by M theory, I mean D equals 11 supergravity, because of course that's the easiest version of M theory that anybody knows anything about. So this is general relativity together with a free-form potential, which I will call A. Letters at the beginning of the alphabet will run over all space and time indices. So the potential A, this gives rise to a field strength, F A B C D, which is equal to 4 into del A and A, B, C, D. You have to add in an action for that, which is minus 1 over 48 F, A, B, C, D squared. And then there's a Chern-Simons term to it, which is, with my conventions, 2 over 12 to the 4th alternating tensor, 1 A and F twice. And I'm going to forget about horrible numbers very shortly. So you can do the same kind of space-time decomposition on this. The free form will divide itself up into two pieces. One where there's a time index here, bij is equal to a0ij, ij being spatial indices. This thing, again, it's something which you can just gauge away, and I will do so. You can put it in if you want to, but it will make your life difficult. So the only bit of this field left is aijk, which gives rise to a field strength psi called fijk, L. So without going through details of how you get there, let's look at what the constraints are going to be under these circumstances. So the constraints get changed slightly. There's going to be the diffeomorphism constraint, that picks up an extra term. Before I tell you what the extra term is, I'd have to tell you my own thing.
Nobody protested when I gauged this away, so I won't go into that. But this thing will have a momentum conjugate to it, which I'll call pi with three indices. So let's call this thing pi ijk. I think it's here somewhere. That turns out to be 1/6 depth of the b-dimensional metric to the 1/2, a dot ijk. That's where the Willis indices downstairs. And then you have to have a correction term coming in the Sherman-Simons term, which is some number times the alternating tensor times A times F. I'm really not going to concentrate on that particular bit of the term. It is not going to feature significantly in what we do. So, the diffeomorphism constraint. Turns out to be minus 2 dj pi ij, what you had to start with. And there's an extra term, plus fijkl pi hat jkl, where pi hat is equal to, this one is pi hat, that one is equal to pi hat. There is a constraint conjugate to vanishing of the momentum of B. So that's a sort of gauge field constraint. That's equal to minus 3 dk of pi hat ijk, and then minus some number times eta ff. Okay, I'm not going to write down what the number is, it's really not going to be very helpful to us. And lastly, there is a Hamiltonian constraint. That is going to be equal to pi ij, as before, minus 1 over z minus 1 times the trace of pi squared, plus pi hat squared. And then there's going to be two terms involving curvature, plus determinant gamma, Ricci scalar, plus 1 over 48 fijkl. Square. Let's write it like that. So the difference between what you had before is that you get a sort of fairly obvious natural term involving the momentum conjugate to A, and you extend the curvature term here by adding something which looks like F squared, a sort of field strength squared, on this pretty natural thing, because it's got the same dimension as this. So what you now ask yourself is, what...
Can you raise the blank for the moment? There was a gamma to the 1/2, or minus 1/2 multiplying before, just below.
Here.
And so the relative weight now is this, this is expressed by the gamma.
Wait a minute. We need to have, to get the proper Hamiltonian constraint, we need to have the gamma to the 1/2 outside the whole.
Okay.
Then people, the momentum, you see, are always... Right, it's minus 1/2. Momentum always tends to densities in my way of doing things. So what we want to ask ourselves is now you've got this bit, which is the kinetic piece of the action, does that thing have any interpretation
analogous to this symmetric space? That's the key point, because if it does, then that's the symmetry which is going to control the nature of this particular theory. So let me tell you what the answer is going to be for various dimensions. I am going to ignore these terms for the moment. I'll come back and say a few words about those at the very end, because they are problematic. So the simplest thing to do is to tell you what the generic answer is, and do one example in a certain amount of detail. So you can have a little list. So if B equals 4, 5, 6, or 7, I am confident of what you get. D equals 8, I am not confident of what it looks like you get. For D equals 9, 10, which are the 10 is the physical one, remember, I have no idea what you get, although things that you could speculate about quite happily. So for D equals 4, then the group in question is E4 divided by SO5. E4 is a strange way of writing SL5. So it corresponds to the following Dynkin diagram. Which is a strange way of writing what you usually think of as being A4. For D equals 5, the answer is E5 divided by SO5 plus SO5. And this thing is going to be SO55, corresponding to this Dynkin diagram. For 6, you can guess the answer. It's going to be E6 divided by USP8. And by USP8, I mean the kind of USP8 that some people call USP4. As opposed to 16, that is. For D equals 7, you get E7 over SU8. And it would be nice to say that for if you did this in dimension 8, you get E8 over SO16, but I really don't want to guarantee that. These are the non-compact forms of the group in each case. So this thing is, of course, already non-compact because it's written in this form. This is non-compact. This is the non-compact form of E6 with signature 6, non-compact form of E7 with signature 7, and the non-compact form of E8 with signature 8. So let's look in a little bit of detail of what happens in D equals 4, because the other examples are basically the same, just more complicated. The real question is, does the diffeomorphism constraint do anything under these symmetries? The answer is it will certainly be controlled by these symmetries, but there is still a question, I suppose, of assembling everything into the right form, and you also have to worry a little bit about the curvature term. The thing that I can say with certainty is that these coset spaces, in each case, control the behavior of the kinetic energy operator. These symmetric spaces control the behavior of the kinetic term. Let me come to that at the very end, because I have a list of 6 problems which will cause difficulties, and that's one of them. So let's do the example of SL5 over SO5. So what we want to do is to generalize the idea of restricted path of the Lorentz group, which was over here, SO4, now to SO5. So enlarge the remains of the Lorentz group, this thing. So how does one actually do that? There is a collection of ideas which go by the name of exceptional geometry, associated with the names of Hitchin and also Hull and various, no doubt, various others that I don't name because of ignorance. The usual way in which you think about geometry, metrics, and sphere binds would be to start off by saying we'll take each point in space and construct in the tangent space a vector. Then there will be a sphere bind which maps this into the space itself. And from that, you can construct a metric so, for example, this thing would be the I, the sphere bind which moves this thing into something which is involves a space-time object will be EIA. So if you constructed EIA VI and called that thing VA, that would be a vector in space-time. And then a metric you can construct by making the product of sphere binds with, in this particular case, it would be the SO4 metric. This thing will give you a metric tensor, gamma ij. And what you would do is you'd say, well, up here, you would be able to identify things like SL4 acting on these, and then symmetric space SL4 over SO4 is what parameterizes these sphere binds. What of this can you apply to the problem that we have here? You want to end up with something which reproduces this kind of structure here. So what you do is you just follow this, but instead of having just vectors, you consider vectors and two-forms. So these, if you think about it, in dimension 4, which is what we're considering here, these things will be four-dimensional, these things will be six-dimensional, and so a generalized vector, which will live in T, and then this will be lambda 2 of T star, will be some 10-dimensional object that looks like VI rho ij, where these things are vectors and these things are two-forms. Then what you want to do is to ask, how does SL5 act on this combination? A subgroup of SL5 is SL4, and SL4 will act on the vectors and the two-forms in the obvious way. So you take a SL4 matrix M and act it on V, that's how it acts on V, and then similarly M transpose rho M is how it acts on rho. So SL4, we're aiming for 24 of these things, here there are of course 15. What about the other 9 elements of SL5? Four of them come from acting with 1, 0, 1, and then theta. Theta is a 3-form. So if this acts on V and rho, this will take you to V and rho plus theta ijk dk. Another of them Another four we found by acting with a three vector, 1 beta 0 1, acting on the row. And that will give you something which looks like VI plus beta IJK, rho JK, and then a rho IJ. So this thing is an anti-symmetric object with three indices, so there's going to be a four of these as well. Lastly, there will be a scale, which has got to preserve the determinant. So the scale would be alpha cubed, 0, 0, 1 over alpha squared, acting on rho and v. And then there are four of these, this will give you a 12, and then there are six of these, so that gives you a minus 12, so that gives you the right thing. So that's how SL5 acts. Now what you need to do is to construct the elements of the coset, those are the analogs of the Fearbine. So we call this a generalized Fearbine. Actually, we call that a Fearbine. So recall that that is a thing which is going to generalize EIA. When you construct a Fearbine, let's call this thing nu, typically you would like it to be, you want a local SO5 to act on the left of this thing, and a rigid SL5 to act on the right. And eventually the metric has got to be invariant under this transformation. And whatever you do, it's got to be independent of K, because K is the object you're going to quotient out by. This is local SO5. So if you think about this, this will be parameterized by 14 objects. And if you want to do this explicitly, you will end up with the following expression. I want to keep that, I guess. Oh, I said I get confused by these things. So let's look at nu. It's got to generalize the conventional notion of a Fearbine. So up in the top left-hand corner, let's put EIA. Typically, when you are faced with something like this, what you do is you use the local gauge invariance to put things into what is usually called the Borel gauge, which means you put this thing into triangular form. So I'll put a zero there. So the remaining bits of this thing will be parameterized by four objects, which are just going to be some kind of field, which I'll call A, which is going to be a three form. And to make my life easy, I have chosen to normalize it this way. I, A, E, B, J, C, up, A, right, I, J, K. And then here I'll have a half of E, I, A, E, J, B, minus the same thing with I and J swapped around. So that's the Fearbine, or I guess we should call this a Funtbine. So this parameterizes coset space. Now what you need to do is to form a metric. symmetric is always going to be given in this way of writing a thing, but that's essentially nu transpose nu, where you contract over the indices A and B. These things, remember, are the tangent space indices. I and so forth will be space-time indices. And if you do this calculation, you will, after a little bit, discover that this thing is equal to gamma ij plus CIKL CJKL A. Well, my notes have to be doing this. Minus A I K L minus A J P Q and a half worth N M. So this is a generalized metric written in terms of a four-dimensional metric and a three-form field A, which parameterizes this coset space. So now what you need to do is to ask yourself whether or not that reproduces the correct theory. So let's calculate the metric on the space of all of these metrics in terms of these field variables. That is to say, we want to calculate trace of M inverse delta M, M inverse delta M. If you do that, you will precisely reproduce this expression here. That shows you that by explicit calculation, generalized geometry of E4 over SO5 reproduces the correct expression to control M theory, where it's to be 4 plus 1 dimensional. So it must be contained in M theory for the very simple reason that all you have done by ignoring the dimensions that we've ignored is just say, well, there's nothing going on in those directions, and the space is going to be flat in those directions. So it's a perfectly reasonable thing to do, yes. Well, so here is, the answer is very simple. I started from knowing this, did the calculation that I've outlined, found this, and discovered they were the same thing. The reason that I did that calculation is because I knew that if I just did pure gravity, I would reproduce the correct duality groups. So the guess was that the duality group was a thing which governed the kinetic energy operator. That's what we've discovered. You could argue that that was fortuitous.
How do you see the duality group from there?
Oh.
I'm not sure I see that.
How do you see it from this?
Yes.
Well, the question is, how do you find that? So if I wrote this thing as some big matrix, X, I, J, X, alpha, beta, and then field alpha, field beta, then up to a change of basis, if I call this thing gamma ij a ij k, then this x corresponds to this metric, and indeed with exactly that parameterization.
Thank you. Is E4 over SO5 a symmetric space?
Yes.
There's no torsion involved in this.
No torsion involved, no. If you thought it would be SL5 over SL5, it would make life easier. because E4 is just the physicist's way of expressing the fact that it belongs to the E series rather than, I mean, it looks like an A series object, it really is E from this point of view. And that becomes more obvious if you went to, say, for example, E6 or E7.
These are all symmetric spaces, aren't they?
These are all symmetric spaces. And if you did the same calculation in E5, 6, or 7, you will get these answers. That they will reproduce the kinetic energy operator that you have up there. So in that sense, the hidden symmetry group which you discover is, in each case, the denominator group here at each point in space. So there's going to be a local SO5. Local in space, remember, is rigid for these things, sometimes depending on this. But it's this thing at each point in space, these things here, governs the symmetry of the theory. So instead of having Lorentz in rows, we have SO5, or SO5 plus SO5, or whatever fulfills that particular need. You do not, I want to emphasize, have to carry out any dimensional reduction to get to this state. It's an exact thing, it does not involve any approximations.
Is that really true? Because you're including more spatial gradients in a sense.
I haven't. So what you're asking about is the driving term.
Yeah.
I can't tell you much about the driving term.
But can I think of that as the natural reduction of very normal spatial gradients?
Well, I think that what you're going to find, if you do this more carefully than I have been able to do, I'm using my words carefully, more carefully than I have been able to do, and you will discover that R plus 48 of F squared is some kind of generalized curvature. But it will be a proper generalized curvature for this kind of geometry. Mm-hmm. I've tried twice to do that calculation, and I get into a mess. It's not that I can't do it, it's just that I get entangled. There has to be a right way of doing that, but I haven't figured out what the right way is. I can show you some wrong way.
I'm just thinking that if I would write an effective action of the full M series, it would have many, many more terms.
Oh, yes.
And so you say none of them would induce more symmetry. That's.
Well, if you use more symmetry, they might induce less symmetry.
You got more symmetry by.
All right. I know what you mean. I said I got a list of six problems, so I'll include that in my list of six problems. So.
Presumably, would the fermions not expand these groups to supergroups?
Yes, that's also on my list of problems. You're only allowed to ask about problems that I don't know about, as opposed to ones that I do. I can tell you why I haven't done any of them. Some answers are flattering, some are not so flattering. problem one. Pi hat, not pi. Pi hat was like pi, if it involved an eta f a term. And that's very bad, because there is absolutely no sign of it in this formula. However, here is my excuse. You only find the Chern-Simons term in dimension 11. Which in my language is d equals 10. You can't possibly find it in any other dimension, so since I can't do dimension 10, I'm not surprised if I haven't found it. Well, problem two. You said, correctly, that I had not put fermions in. I have not put fermions in, and you're quite right in saying that you should get some kind of supergroup if you put fermions in, and I have no idea what those supergroups would be. So my excuse here is laziness. Presumably it will work because if you go back to DeWitt and Nicolai, they seem to find evidence of these groups precisely from looking at how the fermions transform under supersymmetry transformations. So I suspect this will work, but it's just that I haven't had time to do it. For D equals 8, you expect to find the group E8 divided by SO16. And unfortunately, this object contains too many fields.
but not vastly too many fields, a vector's worth too many fields. These are fields that do not show up in supergravity in that dimension. I do not know what to do about that, but I suspect that they are not really propagating fields once you figure out what's really going on. So that is why there's a question mark around what happens there. E8 over SO16 has got too many fields in it. So it has got a metric, it has got a 3-form, it has a 6-form potential, the D of which will give you a 7-form field strength, which is dual to the 4-form field strength that you started with. We're not too bothered about that. And then you end up with a vector. This vector ought to be something like a dual to the graviton field, but I really don't understand how that could possibly work. It's a mystery to me. So for that reason, this thing has a question mark around it. And there was a comment about extra, other extra fields that you'd expect. Well, I presume that you mean the string theory fields elevated up to 11 dimensions. So these are other extra fields. So were I to follow the logic of this, we really want to do the case D equals 10, in which case I'd end up with the object D10. It's certainly a group, but it is a group which has that is infinite dimensional in character. And I will end up with an infinite number of fields if I do this. Nobody really knows what those infinite number of fields are. They're obviously candidates for the higher versions of the string fields, but really, don't ask me anymore because I can't tell you anymore. It's certainly intriguing. E. You might say that doing this in the canonical way was a wimpy thing to do, because after all, we know that covariance is a good idea, usually. So you can ask yourself, why not covariant? And perhaps I'm just being a coward, but I'm really rather afraid of split forms of things, and I'm really not sure that I'm capable technically of disentangling that particular mess. I'm quite happy with the canonical version of the theory. And lastly, you might hope, because the nature of singularities in this picture is clear, because you can identify the boundaries of superspace in a very clear way, that somehow the whole procedure will shed light on singularities. And since this split here is really into a kinetic piece plus a potential bit, it ought to be able to help you to explain what is going on in the billiard picture. So those are all things that one can try and do. Well, let me encourage you to try and do them. And I will stop there. Thank you.
So we have time for a couple of questions. Anyone has something more? We have lots during the talk.
So have people tried to construct some of the potential terms that may inherit?
Oh, you mean like the antecedent of X8, for example?
Sorry?
Like the antecedent of X8? That's the term that involves four Riemann tensors.
Right, I mean, just say try to write down some potential terms that may have that kind of optimistic part.
No, it's a nightmare.
So people have tried that.
It's not that I have any objection to doing it, it's just that it would be a very unpleasant thing to do unless you have some computational tricks that I don't know about.
Okay.
I mean, remember that nobody, I mean, suppose you asked for the supersymmetric extension of X8, so you wanted to find out all the terms that appear. Even in M-theory, you don't know what that is. You know bits of it, but you don't know all of it. So what you could do is, if you believe that everything really behaves in this way, is you could use this invariant to compute what those were directly. But it won't be much fun.
Is there any sense in which pi and pi hat might be canonically related? I mean, you can always change the definite momentum by adding a total time derivative to the action.
You mean, is it d by dt of something? It might be. I can't do the calculation completely in my head. I'll tell you tomorrow. If you're here.
Okay, maybe on that note, we should take a brief break so let Nia prepare for the next talk. And thank you.